Hello and welcome to the Crossbox Podcast. It's still January.
I mean, technically,
yeah. It's not going to be February when we put this out, although we are recording it at the very end of January.
Yeah, that's all right. But it's still within the deadline.
It still counts.
Cut off. Yeah, it's good.
We don't actually have a regular episode planned for you because we had planned to do our very special episode this month, but I got sick on the week when we were going to do that, and I'm still dealing with the cough. So if there's any like lung hacking up sounds, you know who that is. The answer is me. Well, with the whiskey that John poured me. I mean, undoubtedly I will. At any rate, that was not that bad. That's I suppose we have two hybrid topics for you today. Also, I suppose I forgot to say the part where I'm
Jay.
This is my co-host John.
Yeah,
right? But you probably know that already. If this is your first one, well, sorry, go back and listen to a previous one.
Why are you starting in the middle?
Yeah. And at any rate, like I said, we have two hybrid topics for you today. Rather than come up with one topic each on our usual defense, guns, and games, I have a defense and games topic, and John has a defense and guns topic. And I believe John has volunteered to kick us off.
All right. Well, we are American, of course. And in the news, the U.S. military has surprised everyone by completing its modular handgun system selection project.
Who'd have thunk?
Right? They completed it. There was no budget kill. They actually did it in a pretty timely fashion, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have the test details, so I can't say how good the testing was or if they skipped a bunch of stuff. But they got it done, and they have a winner. The SIG P320. Congratulations, SIG.
Ta-da!
It's a wonderful choice. We're going to link to some discussions I have on the P320 and the choice in the description. But I want to talk a little bit about the choice for the P320. The obvious other competitor, Glock, you know, it's the other big 800-pound girl in the room to compare it to. I'm going to do a live radio field strip of a Glock because I need to swap out a trigger bar. And I'm also going to talk about what they moved from the Beretta 92. So let's start there. The Beretta 92, holding one now, it's empty. Look, internet, it's empty, safety Nazis.
I verify that this M9 is empty.
Yes, right. Now, the M9, of course, has been the star of many action movies and was chosen in the 80s as a result of another competition where it won.
Against a SIG, actually.
Yeah, it was actually, right, the final two selections were this and the SIG. And if I can convince Jay to write up a throwback, he's going to do a shootout between this and a P226. But the M9 is pretty typical 80s, like Gen 1 Wonder 9. I think it's fair to call this a Gen 1 Wonder 9.
Yeah.
It's 9mm.
Well, it's maybe like almost proto Wonder 9, though, because it's still aluminum framed, unlike the plastic Fantastic.
Well, yeah, but there were a lot of other aluminum frame Wonder 9s. The CZ-75, the P226. But really, it's Gen 1. Yeah, they're called Gen 1.
So Gen 2 is like the polymer Wonder 9.
Right, okay. You're associated with the Glock, really. Yeah. But so it's got an aluminum frame, as we said. It's 9mm. It holds 15 rounds in the standard magazines. You can get more, but shut up. And it's got a double action mechanism, right? And then it's got, of course, the famous or infamous frame-mounted safety decocker control up on the slide. Exactly. It's served really, really well for many years. Though, of course, there's a lot of complaints about it now, and we'll get to those in a second.
Mm-hmm.
And the SIG P320. I actually like the P320 a lot. I've ordered one.
I feel like the pig isn't necessarily an in-app description.
No, it's quite large.
Yes.
Especially the full-size one. But it's polymer framed. It's striker fired. It actually has a really interesting, mechanism where you can, the guts of it come out and you can swap the plastic frames and the steel slides to get, you know, interchangeability.
Very, modern.
Right. Exactly. It's really cool. So let's talk about some of why do you need a new handgun? Why did you move from double action alloy frame to striker fired polymer frame? And then a little bit about SIG versus Glock. And then because we have to. And then what would I have chosen had I been set up based given the same problem? And I think I did have a procurement games question about that. We're going to link that in the description as well.
All right.
So first, the M9. Now, it's a solid pistol. It has a lot of things that are, and again, many of these things are design compromises, as I'm fond of saying, there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. So let's review. Notable things about the SIG, it has an alloy frame.
The M9.
Sorry, the M9, also the SIG P26. But yes, Jay's going to keep me honest tonight. But notable things about the M9 is, of course, its alloy frame. Now, this is good and bad. It is good because if I am a shooter, bang, 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 alloy frames are heavier than plastic frame, polymer frames. And it absorbs recoil better. This is why lots of competitive shooters will add frame weights to their Glocks. They'll shoot STIs with big, fancy, heavy frames and the like. So if I'm doing a lot of shooting, alloy, good. If I'm carrying it a lot, alloy's bad.
Not because too
good. That's one more thing.
It's heavy.
More weight, right? So this is now advantage polymer, right? We've got two empty ones, and you can really feel the difference in weight.
Well, let me describe what I'm doing here. I'm holding both guns kind of flat in my hand, and the Glock is trying to, like, tip upward because all the weight's in the slide with the magazine out. And the M9 is just kind of flat in my hand because that's what it does.
Yep. And the Glock really feels kind of, you know, toy-like and insubstantial. Which, again, if you're carrying it a lot, that's a plus. Mm-hmm. And in the military, pistols get carried a lot and probably shot less.
Pretty little.
Yeah, relatively speaking.
Yeah.
So, again, trade-offs. But, you know, that's a clear trade-off. Second thing we're going to talk about, of course, the M9 is always aging. And there's a number of things that were, you know, things you did back then that you don't do anymore. And there's also the fact that just, you know, things wear out. And as a whole, the Army is very bad at keeping up with maintenance cycles, adequate lube.
And not necessarily because it's, you know, a bad Army, just because these things are in the hands of soldiers who ordinarily have more important things on their mind than oiling and cleaning their firearms.
Right, or replacing springs when they need to.
Right.
So you have pistols that are worn out, and this isn't a fault of the M9, but this is just any pistol that's in service for that long is going to need replacement.
And it's had, you know, 20,000 rounds through it.
Exactly, right. And it's been dragged through the sandbox. It's been issued and replaced in the armory a bunch of times. It doesn't really belong to anyone, so nobody really cares for it. Otherwise, and then there's a couple minor things about the design that I want to talk about as well. One major one, but some minor things. Right now we've got sights. The rear sight, it appears to be plastic. And the front sight is built into the frame. It's, you know, it's a two-dot, like, vertical dot kind of thing. Jay likes to call it a snowman sight picture.
Doesn't look very much like a snowman.
But it's the standard sight picture. And then without basically a drill press, you can't do anything to it. So if you wanted, from the military standpoint, tritium, you're SOL.
Yeah, there's not really a way to do that to the front sight.
Right. You could technically get a drill press. The Army's not going to do that.
Right.
The other thing, it's kind of large. Now, I have big-ish hands with mostly really long fingers, so I don't really have a problem with this gun. Jay's hands are kind of normal size.
Well, they're about the same size as John's. It's just I have much shorter fingers. And so some of the controls are a little bit tough for me.
A little reacher, but he's okay with it. The problem comes if you have a smaller person or a girl. Yes, there are girls in the Army. And they will have a lot of trouble reaching the controls, so specifically the mag release, the slide-mounted safety decocker, and the trigger in double action mode has a long reach. And there's not a lot you can do to the M9 as designed to deal with some people having little bitty hands. And now let's talk about the elephant in the room, shall we?
Shall we?
All right. Well, the elephant in the gun. The SIG has a traditional double action trigger, also known as traditional double action, single action. There's all manner.
M9.
Ah, I keep doing that. I might have to redo this. No, we won't. The Beretta.
As if I'd spend that much time on the audio engineering.
Right. You'll just have all these, you know, things of me getting confused because I'm so used to all the older SIGs that have double action pistols.
The same.
The P320 is SIG's only striker fired gun. The Beretta M9 has a double action hammer and mechanism. Now, again, this is a trade-off. A double-action pistol, presuming you remember to do your due diligence on decocking, has more safety features than, say, a striker-fired automatic. The trigger pull, or the first-shot trigger pull, is longer and heavier.
But the single-action trigger pull is ordinarily cleaner and, well, just better.
Right, it's shorter and lighter and cleaner. It's a better pull. And then, of course, you have a control to worry about to work with up on the slide. You have to remember to work. I'm going to get shortly on the soapbox, there's going to be a post about when you want to decock, but in general, you don't want to leave this in single action mode because then you have a trigger that's lighter and scarier than a Glock.
Right. There's no real take up besides just getting to the break in the first place.
Yep. Yeah. It's really short and light. And
once there's resistance, you pull and then it goes off. There's no moment to change your mind,
to say, hey, moron, you're pulling the trigger.
Right.
And trigger checking's a thing. And, you know, so that's the thing. Now, just to be clear, what I mean by trigger checking is you are on some kind of stressful black ops and you're scared and your adrenaline's pumped, your heart's beating at like 180 beats per minute and your adrenaline's going through your veins. And what you'll do often, unless you've really trained the hell out of this, you will subconsciously say, hey, Trigger, are you still there? Oops. Oh, fuck. And now here...
Now they know you're there.
I say, oh, fuck, and there's no problem because the gun was unloaded. Yeah. You know, that goes bang, where did that go? Did that hit some kindergartner?
Or, you know, the guy's in the stack in front of you.
Right, who's going to be pissed off, maybe his armor, and you're just like, dude, what the hell? They know you're there. So that's bad.
Yeah.
The downside, of course, is there's two trigger pulls, and there's, of course, the obvious transition from the one to the other. Right? First shot, well, first shot since I've decocked, and my subsequent shots.
Well, and especially as a primarily double action shooter myself, I can tell you that in like stressful or high intensity situations, having that heavier first pull is nice as a safety feature, but it's a handicap going to that single action pull because you just had to pull really hard to get that trigger to go.
Yep, exactly. And you had to pull a long distance.
Yeah, and then you're in that same mode.
Right. Your brain is bad at transitioning.
Until you've trained that out. And I haven't. I haven't shot. I don't shoot enough to do that, probably.
Yep. So the trade-off you get some more safety with it. Not saying that Glocks are unsafe. Not saying that you can't have an accident with a Beretta because it's designed to be shot.
Yes.
So you can be stupid enough to shoot yourself with it.
As with all firearms.
Yep. Right? But the striker-fired autos like a Glock or the SIG P320 are a lot easier to reach a given level of proficiency, right? So if you have some qual you got to make, you'll need less training hours on the striker-fired gun to get there.
And we should point out that this, as a military sidearm, that's an excellent thing to have because, again, it's not going to get trained nearly as much as the rifle. And it's not going to get used nearly as much as the rifle. So it should be as easy as possible to develop those skills and keep them in your mind.
Exactly. And you have a lot of other crap to qualify on, right?
Yeah.
It's more fun and you're going to use a lot more. So there's definitely some advantages in going striker-fired. And Beretta had actually offered a revised version, the M9A3, which fixes a lot of the problems of the M9 other than the mechanism.
Replaceable sights, I believe, too.
Yep, replaceable sights, redesigned grip to work for smaller people, new everything.
Bigger controls.
Yeah, bigger controls.
I suppose you usually see it in like the desert tan color.
Oh, exactly, right? Because that's cool. The Beretta said you could replace it. You could replace it without changing your original contract. I'm personally skeptical. I know that when the FBI wanted to go from their 40 caliber Glock to a new pistol, their original plan was, we'll just buy 9mm Glocks. Their lawyers said, no, actually, you have to have a contract. Someone's going to complain. So I'm pretty sure the complaints might have been valid here, but I don't know. That's not what the Army did, and I'm not actually a contract lawyer. So let's go ahead and decock that. Thank you, Jay, for bringing your Beretta M9.
I'd like to say one more thing, just because, as you may know, I'm something of a gun hipster, and you might say to yourself, what, an M9? That's pretty boring.
Yep.
Like, right?
Pedestrian.
Pedestrian. Everyone has one. And while it's true, it's popular and it's descended from something popular, it features an operating mechanism that's at least a little bit unusual.
Yeah.
It's descended from / based on / in the same vein as the P38. Rather than the Browning tilting barrel design you see on almost every other pistol, it has a falling locking block sort of thing. So when you pull back on the slide, the barrel and the slide move together for a little bit. A locking block beneath the barrel drops down to unlock everything, and then the slide keeps on going back, as opposed to the tilt. Which is interesting, because if you open one up, which I'm going to do, not that you can see. Well, there's not a magazine in here either. But if there were, and you could see it, you would see that the magazine is directly in line with the barrel, so there's no feed ramp or anything. It just goes to the back of the slide, just puts it straight in, which is fascinating. I think interesting and worth.
Worth technologically, it's a neat pistol.
Yes, and I like unusual. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk a little bit. Striker fire autos. I'm a huge fan. You probably know that. I'm a Glock guy. I have lots of Glocks. I love them. So there's a natural bit of competition here, which was the better choice, which should the Army have picked, blah, blah, blah. I'm not them. They had a very rigid set of requirements. Glocks are reliable. SIGs are reliable. On the one hand, the Glock is a venerable design. They're basically unchanged from what came out in the late 80s, sort of mid to late 80s, imported here, late 80s. It's been around forever. It has a reputation of reliability up there with the AK-47 as basically unkillable.
Pretty much. At least in normal operation.
Right. I mean, I could strap C4 to it and blow it up.
Well, let's talk about briefly about a test that both the Glock and the AK more or less fail, which is, jamming mud into the slidey bits.
Yeah. So at gun school, AK fails. We'll link to
Ian and Carl, the Forgotten Weapons guys. Yep. They do that. They've got the really the most brutal mud test you've ever seen.
Yep. Well, no, the most brutal mud test was at gun school when my instructor took my Glock, locked the slide open, jammed mud into every nook and cranny, jammed it up into the back of the slide, and basically everywhere he could think of to jam it, and then loaded it and said, "Here you go, guys, clear the malfunction. The gun will fire, it just won't extract properly, and you have to manually cycle it every time."
I believe that was more or less what the AK did.
Yeah. It was...
The cycling nungler works because there's, you know, stuff where it wants to go.
Yep. So that's like the one... So you can kill him. It's just really, really hard under normal operating conditions. That's actually my one possible question about the SIG. My one bit of misgivings about the SIG is that the design is relatively new.
Doesn't have that same reputation for bulletproofness.
Now, it's based off the SIG P250, which sold terribly because the launch was awful, and it had a consistent double-action-only trigger pull, which is going to go over like...
lead balloon.
Yeah, pretty much. Just thunk. People don't like that. People like a good trigger pull. People like to go shooting with their guns in America.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a number of high-profile agencies that tried the P250 and hated it. So, and actually, that gun is being discontinued.
Yeah.
So SIG's no longer producing them. Why not make the P320 that they need the capacity for the Army? People like those. They're good.
And there's always a certain cachet to the current issue sidearm.
Exactly. So personally, if you said, John, you got to pick the two, and I was the one in charge of my own requirements, I would go with the Glock just because I don't want to be the first one to adopt something.
Does Glock have any... experience with military contracts?
God, yes. Okay. So SOCOM loves them here.
Okay.
Has been SOCOM's sidearm of choice. It's been Glock 19s. They originally developed for the Austrian military and have seen a wide number of military contracts. They've got 65% of the law enforcement market, yeah, and they beat the SIG in the FBI test.
Well, law enforcement and military are different, I would say.
So, yeah, that's true.
Like, the having experience with being like the main contractor for an army.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. When the Brits wanted to finally replace their Browning High Powers, they went with Glock 17s.
Oh, there you go.
And that's just the one off the top of my head. On Wikipedia, you can see there's tons of happy Glock users out there in the military. So personally, I don't like being, one of my things for procurement of especially small arms is,
don't be the first guy.
Right. And there's the SIG has a better trigger than the Glock. That's good and bad in some ways. Personally, I really think the Glock trigger is a decent compromise between shootability and safety. It's kind of a deliberate pull. It's not great, but it's also not really a great pull either. So it's got kind of a mushy take up and then a wall where you drop the striker. And that really requires you to, pull with some deliberation. So it's not as good as a double action trigger, but it's also more shootable than a double action trigger. Something interesting. So the U.S. military went with a P320 with a thumb safety, and Glocks have never got on with manual safeties very well. The design is probably too simple for you to jam that in, and that's actually, I think, one of the better reasons to go with the SIG, because from an apples-to-apples comparison, the two are really identical. They shoot 9mm bullets, they're well-designed, they're nice, they're pretty easy to shoot. They're cheap. They're both polymer frames. They're cheaper for manufacturer make, which is cheaper for you. They both don't require a lot of maintenance. They're not really lubrication dependent, unlike an alloy frame gun. So there's a lot of good things in both of them. Personally, I lean towards the proven reliability of the Glock, because there's a lot of things that get shaken out when you first mass issue something to a bunch of schmucks who don't care. But if the manual safety is a thing for you, that's going SIG is probably a better call. I don't know how the SIG is on small parts internally, but we're going to take a Glock apart. And just one more thing before, as I get started.
Let's get the timer out and see
what the time is?
Yep.
That's all right, I won't be going particularly fast.
But. Well, that's okay. I mean, I feel like it's probably still going to be indicative of something.
Yep.
All right, the stopwatch is...
Well, actually, wait. Before we say that, just one interesting thing.
Yeah.
A gun with SIG P320s tend to have about a 7.5-pound trigger pull on average. And with a manual safety, thumb safety, a short 7.5-8-pound trigger pull, that sounds an awful lot like an original M1911. Right? So we've gone full circle. We've come back to basically something like same kind of really short trigger. Again, we're not talking about, my Springfield Professional or a Nighthawk Custom or anything sweet like that. We're talking about like an old 1917, the 1941. USGI, yeah. Exactly. An issued Colt with loose tolerances. All right, so, Glock, well, let's do this honestly.
Three, two, One, go.
All right, so we're going to walk it back, verify that there's nothing in the chamber.
There is nothing in the chamber.
All right. Drop the slide. Dry fire. Gunsmith hold. Pull down on the stupid little tab thing. Slide comes off. Recoil spring assembly out. Barrel out. At this point, we are field stripped, but that's not enough. So we're going to grab our handy Glock tool, which is a 3mm punch. If you're in America, a 3/8-inch punch will work just as well. Pop out. I like to punch out the bigger of the two trigger pins first, because then the slide release comes out a little easier. Then you knock out the little one. Lift out the locking block. Pop out the trigger housing pin. Lift out the trigger assembly. Then you pop out the connector. A little bit stubborn, because I haven't done this before on this gun. Oh, come on, you. Maybe we'll come out a different way. We will lift out the trigger bar first.
This little assembly of toaster parts and John's parts box is pretty amusing.
Oh, it's going to get more amusing. This is always the...
tricky part. I see there's like a spring kind of pushing...
Yeah, you're fighting a... Yeah. You're fighting the trigger return spring. And again, I haven't disassembled this one too much, so...
And so the trigger return spring there is mounted in a, kind of in a housing so that when it pushes on one side.
It seems like it
pulls on one side, so you've got to both... move against the spring and keep the trigger assembly straight as you're pulling out.
All right, so we've removed the trigger bar, the trigger return spring, the trigger housing with the ejector, which is pressed in, does not come out, and the connector came out with some fussing. Moving on to the slide. I'm not going to remove the sights, of course. You press down on the striker, and then you slide off the striker retaining plate. Throw that in the box, will you, guys?
There you go.
All right. And then out comes the extractor spring, the striker. Do you want me to disassemble this further? Yes, I think so.
Go for it.
All right. Turn it sideways. Push down on the spring. Lift out the two little annoying fiddly spring cups. Spring comes out. I'm actually going to leave that on because I don't feel like fussing with it. All right. Now two more parts to go, and then we're done. You actually press down on the safety plunger, and out comes the extractor, and then out comes the safety plunger with its spring, which is small, and I'm not going to remove it. Done.
Well, there you go. That's in 2 minutes and 41 seconds, not going especially fast, and struggling with a part that was only stiff because he hasn't done it on this gun before.
Exactly. So we're actually going to swap a couple parts. I'm going to take out the trigger bar and put in a different one, and there we go. So that's it. And really, so what do you think of these parts, Jay?
Yeah, definitely toaster bits, like... This is the spring that pushes the bread back up when it's done. this is the lever that you push down on, except without its plastic housing. It's just like the, you know, just a little tab on the end you push down on it.
It's the Soviet version. And it tells you when your bread's done.
Not sure what this is. Maybe like part of the...
It holds the heating element.
Well, it holds the heating. There's like the part at the bottom, like at the basket. Like the
right, it catches the bread thing and prevents it from going all the way to the bottom and being burned.
Yeah.
Here, this is a heating element spring.
Heating element spring, yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
Yep.
I mean, there's even one of these, like, one of these springs, the kind where the ends are bent up into little U-shapes perpendicular to the other coils to, like, hold on to two ends, which is definitely something I've seen in a toaster.
Yep. All right, so we had about a little under 3 minutes to disassemble?
Yeah, 2 minutes and 41 seconds.
Cool. All right, let's... You might have written that down somewhere, because that's interesting.
Got a pen.
Oh, you do? Great. Okay. Because I'm also going to have you say, well, you know, if you're going to time me on that, you should time me on the reassembly as well, right?
241 dis. Let me get my stopwatch back out and reset it.
All right.
Reset. Ready?
Yep.
Go. I feel like this may be a little bit slower in the way that all reassemblies are usually slightly slower than disassemblies. I mean, it's the directions are easier because you've already taken everything apart and you know what you're doing. But at the same time, reassembling is usually more precision-based, especially when you've got springs to worry about.
Yep. There's probably a little bit of spring tension fighting in here.
It's probably a wash working on a car. Yeah. Because of that, like, everything's, you know, ratcheting. Oh, that goes there because I took it off of there. And then you always end up with those three little screws left that you don't remember where you took them from.
Yep. But in this case, there's not actually enough springs to get enough parts to get to that point.
I believe they're all differently sized, too.
Yeah.
Like the two closest ones are the smaller diameter of the trigger pins and the trigger housing pin, was it?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, those except the same. One is longer.
Right, those are the same diameter, but one is, you know, distinctly longer than the others. So.
Yep.
So now he's putting the striker.
The striker on with the little spring cups, which are a massive pain because you have to fight the striker spring. Yep. In that goes, and in goes the little
extractor assembly. And
yeah, the extractor return assembly. Then you do a little bit of pressing, and again, the only tool you need is this little punch. And really, the Glock disassembly tool is a punch with a nice handle on it. That's all it is.
In the same sense that we've got toaster parts here, we also have, the toolkit isn't really a toolkit per se.
Nope.
This isn't like an AR armorer's wrench or anything.
Oh, damn.
What's up?
I put the extractor return thing in wrong.
Ah.
Oh, silly of me.
Well, you wasted some time there.
But. Yeah, I really did. You know, clock jitters.
Yeah.
All right,
gotta start timing yourself for practice now.
Exactly, right?
I think that's the slide back together now.
Yep, slide assembled. Now for the trigger assembly, the trigger housing.
Placing the trigger back onto the trigger bar.
Mm-hmm. Always super fun. And always goes back on more easily than it comes off.
Which is a little bit unusual when there are springs involved. But I guess this is a pulley spring, right?
Right. Yeah. And it's also like working with you this way. So in goes the connector. Oops, that came off. And sometimes things, you know, pop off their darn springs.
Yes.
But that happens.
There we go.
So there we go. In that goes. And get the... throw it across the room. Oh, into my shirt.
Oh, that's a relief.
Aha!
That could have really, really ruined your time.
Oh, no. Yeah, I know, right? Well, getting the part in backwards was bad.
Yeah.
So now I put in the trigger housing retaining pin, the locking block pin. Now you always put the small locking block retaining pin in first, then the slide stop, which is the shoddiest looking part imaginable, the trigger retaining spring, and then we complete by returning everything to its original condition.
That's the recoil spring under the barrel back into the slide, the... and the Glock back together in 3 minutes and 36 seconds.
Not bad. So I probably could have gotten that.
Lost a little bit of time with the parts wrong and, like I said, the clock jitters. But
But, you know, I think that's respectable, again, because I don't usually do this on the clock.
Put down 3:36 for reassembly.
Yeah. But yeah, it's stupidly simple, and that's actually something that is a Glock advantage, again, especially for the Army.
Yeah.
It's an advantage for me, the kitchen table gunsmith, because I can make all kinds of changes without much worry about breaking it.
Or, you know, buying specialized tools.
Right. And it's an advantage for the Army because, you know, I mean, gee, if I can do it, any yabo can do it.
Yeah. Well, any, like...
I say that.
Any moderately educated yabo.
Right. You can pretty easily train a guy to get through the Glock armor's proficiency.
Maybe not the average grunt.
Yeah. And that's definitely an advantage. I actually don't know how complicated the SIGs are. And, rest assured that when I get one...
Which we should mention is happening.
Yeah, which is happening. The fun of no feed layaway, always nice.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got a P320 TACOPS coming, full size, and I'll talk about, how complicated is this darn thing?
We'll probably have a little old versus new article, too, between the M9. A little shoot-off between the M9 and the P320.
Yep, that should be lots of fun to look forward to. So that basically covers it. I think the Army, you know, did pretty good with their choice. Mm-hmm. There's not really a lot I can complain about other than they're the first big agency to go with something that usually makes bugs fall out. But it's a respectable choice. I probably would have gone Glock just because I know them and I know how reliable they are. But I can't really say that, the P320 was a bad choice.
Yeah. That might be a fun test, the 15-yard plates, time to knock them all down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be.
Granted, that's definitely one that's got to be a... We would each have to shoot it with both guns. Right. We can't exactly compare.
Right. The other thing is I've got, like, a lot of time on Glocks. I'm really used to them.
There's a little, like, Ian Carl thing going on here, right?
Yeah, I think so.
He's the better shooter than I am.
It happens.
Yeah. He also spends more time practicing.
Right. Yeah,
I don't begrudge him being better given the amount of effort he's put into it.
Right. I take, you know, classes and burn through 1,000 rounds in a weekend, you know, in the mud and pouring rain. You know.
I don't think I've shot 1,000 rounds in the last year. And that's with a couple of two-gun matches in there, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've got, like, classes is probably about 2,500 rounds, 2,600, give or take, something up there.
I mean, sounds about right.
A lot of bullets to shot. You know, and I mean, we even have like instructors simulating terrorist attacks by firing AKs, you know,
nice
in a safe direction, yeah. but near us,
yeah,
which was lots of fun. You know, so they weren't shooting at us, but they were shooting, you know, yeah. perpendicular.
That's probably a lot of liability concerns.
Oh, yeah,
shooting at you,
exactly. Yeah. Right? We don't want that. We paid to, you know, learn things, not get shot,
also not to pay for their liability insurance for shooting at you,
right? Exactly. You know, that's don't be dumb.
I have no doubt the liability insurance to run a firearms training business is already fairly expensive.
Yeah, I know, right? It already sucks. So there we go, guys. Lots of fun there. So that's kind of a really brand new topic. But actually, I'm going to set this aside for a minute. Jay,
yes?
Hand me that Beretta 92 again, because this is actually a nice segue. So the Beretta 92, despite the number, M9, Beretta 92, it was not, in fact, a product of the 90s. It was designed in the early 80s, which was also the heyday of a fighter that's very near and dear to your heart.
I mean, the FS was, but I don't want to ruin your segue.
Just, no.
But actually, they're even more contemporaneous, like the original Model 92 and what John's
exactly,
about to
right?
segue
because
into.
What people don't realize, the safety decocker was actually added at the behest of the U.S. Army.
Yeah.
And originally, the Beretta 92, not the FS, the original 92, no letters, had a slide-mounted safety, which you can still see on a Taurus PT-92, because that was made on basically old Beretta machinery. Mm-hmm. Beretta had a contract for 92, no letters, no slide stuff.
Brazil. Tiny sights and a magazine release down there in the heel.
Yeah.
Anyway, and that was a 70s gun.
Right. What else came out in the 70s? Star Wars came out in the 70s,
didn't it? In the late 70s.
Yeah, late 70s.
If you go a little bit further back, though, you come across a very interesting piece of military history.
That's right.
And it is not out of the United States. It's not out of the Soviet Union. It's not out of England, France, or Germany. It is, in fact, out of Sweden.
Jay has a massive love affair with Swedish things.
It's true. We're talking about the AJ-37 Viggen. It's really an airplane of firsts. I'll cover a couple of them here. It's the first aircraft designed to include a digital flight control and aiming and attack and navigation system. The first aircraft designed to use an afterburning turbofan. Those are the two big ones. The first canarded aircraft to enter serious service with anybody. There were some canarded designs going all the way back to World War II, but those never really got past the prototype.
They never
stage.
Took off, you might say.
Well, you might.
Yeah.
play that sound effect there.
Yep.
Anyway, so the Viggen is an aircraft of firsts. It was a standard design in 1960 exactly when the Swedes were looking to their east and seeing only Finland between them and the Soviets. I think that wasn't the safest of situations.
Not a good buffer state.
Although, as the Finns are fond of saying, the Swedes were happy to fight the last Finn.
Right.
Yeah. So lots of Nordic fun there. Anyway, the Viggen was designed to replace the Saab 32 Lansen, a first generation transonic jet attack aircraft.
For our audience listening at home who may not be, in fact, jet aircraft experts, when you say first generation jet fighter aircraft, what do you mean by that? And could you provide some American or Russian examples of the type?
Well, so you have like the F-86 or the MiG-15, or I suppose to some degree the MiG-17,
yeah.
The MiG-19s. It's got a lot of trends on it, like a lot of first generation features, but it's really kind of pushing into the second generation. Anyway, so the main feature of the design are a conventional planform with swept wings, a single jet engine with the intake in the nose, which of course causes trouble when you want to put a radar there.
Right.
As the Russians found out with the MiG-21.
Yeah.
And when they had a cone at least, but even that's a very small cone
also
compared to the size of radar you'd want.
F-84D.
Yeah, same idea.
Hideous plane.
Anyway, so you've got that single non-afterburning turbo jet, and usually a primary gun armament.
Right.
Yeah. So the first generation was coming to a close, and the second generation was upon us.
Okay. And what are some features of the second generation of aircraft?
I say you see a lot of delta wings in the second generation.
All right.
You see afterburning turbo jets.
Right.
Most ordinarily. You see, sometimes guns, as in the F8, I think the F8's
pretty
solid second-generation plane.
Yep.
But you also just as much see planes that are designed with no gun whatsoever and a primary missile armament.
Right, therefore Phantom.
Yes. Or many versions of the MiG-21.
Right.
Yeah, they're that rough contemporary.
Yeah.
So you've got those features. And then this is 1960, so we're pretty firmly into those second-generation designs now.
Right.
But Saab was forward-thinking, because Saab, being a defense contractor for a small country, Sweden, realized that their plane wouldn't be coming to service for, 5 to 10 years. So they tried to look 5 to 10 years into the future. And I'd say they succeeded pretty admirably. It's kind of almost a transitional between second and third generation design.
Yeah.
Even like slanting somewhat third, because you've got some of those third generation features like a heads-up display.
Right.
And an afterburning turbo fan.
Right.
And, a computer.
Right.
Or as exactly. as the Swedes called it in the Viggen, a central calculator.
Right. Now, just for contemporaries here, if you look at what kind of role would you say this plane is designed to have?
Well, the Viggen is an interdictor, which is a very specialized kind of strike fighter. It was common in its era, the design era, the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Right.
It's designed in that high-speed, low-altitude, one-pass sort of mentality. You program with the target ahead of time, you fly the route exactly as designed on the deck, you pop up briefly to find where your target is, you drop your bombs or shoot your rockets, and then you get out.
Right. And it's interesting that it's kind of somewhere in between, say, an American F-105, which is a single seat, but doesn't have the, what'd you call it?
This.
Calculator?
A calculator, with a Y in the middle there.
Calculator. Yeah, whatever. It doesn't have an integrated computer like the Viggen does, but it does have that single seat, kind of a high-speed profile, but designed for a nuke, so precision not really an issue. The other one, though, the size is much different. The role is similar to the American F-111. Much bigger. It has, it can haul a ton of stuff for really long ways, but that is a two-seat aircraft with like a navigator, bombardier, crew station.
Right.
And that's something that that entered service probably right around the same time as the Viggen, give or take. Close enough for government work here. And that's really something pretty cool that you can have you can really one up the Americans in, not getting rid of that navigator bombardier position.
Yeah. And I think that we should mention that also similar in that, what Wikipedia would call similar role configuration and era.
Yep.
You have the A7 Corsair II.
Right.
Which actually kind of stole the Viggen's thunder in a lot of ways. I believe it was the first fighter with a turbofan, although not an afterburning one.
Right.
And it also had a computer and navigation system and aiming system in the same sense that Viggen did. That said, the roles are kind of different because, the Corsair is more light attack.
It's a pretty straight attack plane.
Yeah, it doesn't have that supersonic speed.
Right, and the Viggen makes an okay fighter if you force it to. The Corsair is not a fighter.
Right.
Even though it's been derived from the F-8 Crusader, which was a wonderful fighter, the Corsair has been configured in such a way that it doesn't really do
its job is attack.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's what it does.
It's not
it's
very
quite
fast.
Good at
it doesn't excuse me. It's not very not especially agile.
Nope.
And doesn't support a great deal in the way of air-to-air munitions.
Right.
Yeah. At any rate, so it's 1960. We're in those Swedish workshops with the magical Saab fighter elves. And
do they wear short skirts?
I don't know. Anyway, they have they've got this design in mind to replace the aging Lansen. Now, the Swedes are actually very well suited to the interdictor role because their main military concern is defending against a Soviet invasion, and that really gives you lots of room to practice your navigation through particular bits of your landscape that are good for hiding and difficult for the enemy to cover. That plays heavily into their ideas. And really, they designed a Humdinger.
Beg your pardon.
A Humdinger.
A what?
A Humdinger. You look at it from the top. It's a wonderful canarded double delta profile.
Jay loves canards.
I do. I do really, really like canards.
Because Spike has canards.
No. tailless delta. Maybe one of the first of its kind, too, isn't it?
Well, no. No, we had a lot of tailless deltas before that. I mean, it depends, because we had a lot of tail delta, regular tailless deltas, sans canards. And you had a few weird things the Israelis were doing around the same time with, the Kafir and Mirage variants that had non-moving canards as, aids to things. But I'm pretty sure these are moving canards.
On the Viggen? No, they're not.
Oh, well, never mind. There you go.
They've got they're flaps, but,
okay.
Yeah. Those are for landing only. Anyway, on that note.
Something to look up.
Yeah, The Viggen is a, of course, designed to fit into the Swedish military strategy, which is, if we need to, we're going to base these things out of highways. There are a lot of, like, half-kilometer or kilometer-long straightways on highways in Sweden with, you know, nice reinforced concrete pads that you can land a fighter on, for instance. And the Viggen has plenty of features that are made, you know, specifically for that short landing thing. The canards, for one, which are great for your low-altitude, great for your low-speed lift, rather, along with the Delta. You get, like, a lot of a high angle of attack performance there. You have a thrust reverser, which is another first for a fighter. And this is not a very common feature for fighters at all, just because the things that, you know, everyone else designs to land on very short spaces tend to have, like, hooks to catch the cable.
Right. Yeah. And if you have, you know, an arresting system to take advantage of, why bother?
Exactly.
Nothing to break.
Yeah. It's got a main gear with a bogey with two wheels that's made to touch down with the rear wheels first and then kind of rotate forward to absorb some of the shock of a hard landing. I guess most of the features. The thrust reverser means that it's relatively unique among strike fighters in the fact that it can reverse.
Yep.
Which isn't, you know, super useful unless you're making a 3-point turn on a highway to take off again. But you know, that could have happened.
Yep.
Now the Viggen never saw real combat. It was, I believe, scrambled once in response to a Soviet submarine grounding on a Swedish island, and the Soviet Navy, of course, came rushing out to the rescue of the stricken submarine, and the Swedes quite reasonably thought, oh no, it's finally happening, and scrambled a bunch of things, and I don't believe anybody died, but it was a tense couple of minutes in the Baltic.
Yep.
All right. So the calculator, I want to touch on the computer a little bit, because the computer is super cool, and I'm kind of a computer nerd myself, as, you know, my profession and the way I spend my time might suggest. It's actually one of the first computers, the first computer ever put into an airplane, and one of the first small, lightweight computers ever built. The prototyping began in 1960, and for some time, Saab was, in fact, the world's largest purchaser of computer components. They switched to integrated circuits in, I think, 1961, after they finished the prototype. The prototype was a giant console-sized thing, with, you know, an operator sitting in front of it and plugging in numbers and such. But it did successfully demo all the programs they wanted to run on it, like weapons aiming and Doppler navigation, both of which are, you know, super cool features in a plane from 1971. The final version was finished in the later 60s. It used integrated circuits and was one of the first computers to do that. Saab was again the largest purchaser of integrated circuits for some time in the world. And as a fun little historical fact, there were two competitors in the program to supply integrated circuits to the Viggen program, and they were Texas Instruments and Fairchild, and Fairchild beat Texas Instruments, the, you know, people you think of as kind of the integrated circuit people today.
Right.
Or today you think of them as the integrated circuit people of yesterday, but
yeah, and the calculator people of today still.
But somehow. I mean, does Fairchild doesn't even exist anymore, and they're like part of something else.
Yeah. Eaton.
Well, Eaton, and then like re-eaten and re-eaten.
They've probably broken up.
You have, like, you know, your Northrops and your Grumman's and your Lockheed's, which are, you know, all independent corporations, even your Martin Marietta, but
yep.
They, those names still survive in our current aviation conglomerates. Fairchild is just gone.
Yeah. Maybe we'll listen to a corporate history of Fairchild. I think we have a lot of corporate history listeners. If you like corporate history, you should write to us as, why don't you care more about my hobby?
Yeah. On the back of a $20 bill.
Yep, that's right. That's right. And then send it to Box 742. Yeah. Sewickley, Pennsylvania, 15143.
But Strictly Pa, right?
Yeah, right. Strictly Pa.
If we're going to take off the car talk, guys.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So the Viggen was originally designed to carry the same weapons the Lansen did. That's mostly unguided stuff. You have a 13.5-centimeter rocket. The Swedes, being Germanic people, like to measure their rockets in centimeters, which I appreciate. And
he's allergic to millimeters, you know.
It's true. And dumb bombs of the 120-kilogram weight. The Viggen can carry 16 of those on racks of four. You have 7 hardpoints altogether. One in the center line, usually used for a fuel tank, because that afterburner is thirsty. All right, let's talk about the engine for a moment.
All right.
It's a Pratt & Whitney design. It's actually the engine, the single installation engine that was also used on the 707 and 727 back in the day, the Pratt & Whitney JT-8. So the Swedes took that and said, this isn't going to work, and redesigned a bunch of it to fit into a fighter and then put an afterburner on the back because, like, I get the sense that between, like, the car, like, the ice racing and just, like, really, like, everything I've heard about Sweden, that they're a little
speed
bit
crazy.
Speed crazy, like, maybe reckless as far as engineers go, but it turned out.
Also, remember, you're dealing with the formidable, terrifying, scary Soviet air defense systems.
That's true.
You want all of the low-altitude speed you can possibly muster.
And really, they got a lot out of it. So you've got, like, your airliner engine. It's, you know, kind of big. And they put the afterburner on the back. This afterburner has three stages, which click nicely in the cockpit as you push the throttle through those detents.
So what you're telling me is they hot-rotted an airliner.
They hot-rotted an airliner engine and put it in their strike fighter.
It's a good call.
Yeah. So you've got, like, this massive fuselage. And it's not quite F-35 profile, but it's still fairly fat. Yeah. And it's got those two giant intakes because it takes a lot of air to power a turbo, for like to suck through a turbofan.
Mm-hmm.
At full throttle, at full afterburner, full stage three afterburner on the deck, you go through about 20% of your fuel every minute. Yeah,
nice.
It's a thrusty, as they say. So they over the years they upgraded it a couple of times to add new weapons. There's the Well, I guess it was designed with the RB-04 anti-ship missile in mind, and the RB-05A manual control line of sight thing with the flare in the back and the little stick in the cockpit. And you point the flare over the target and hope, you know, really pray that you hit it.
Yeah.
Over the years, they added support for the RB-75, which our American listeners know as the AGM-65 or Maverick, because the Swedes have this thing about not naming any missiles. Like, not keeping any other Western names for missiles. The Sidewinders were the RB-24 and the RB-74 because,
yeah, I think so.
Yeah, they couldn't stick with it. Yep. And in the 1990s, the late 1990s, the early 1990s, they looked at the Soviet bear again. At the time they looked at it, the Soviet bear was still kind of scary as opposed to, you know, collapsed.
Yeah,
and they thought to themselves, well, the Gripen's not done yet. But we have all these fancy new weapons, so they embarked on a modernization program, which yielded the AJS-37 Viggen. That being the modernized version that came out of it. So they did a couple of things. They added a data cartridge and improved the processing power of the computer somewhat, given that it could already do a blistering 200,000 instructions per second in 1971. I feel like how much more could they have done?
Well, you know, 640K is all you need, right,
bud? Yeah, even that. It had like, I think it had it was 28-bit words. They had 8,000, so it was like 6,000 bytes of storage.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The upgrade is to 640K.
Right,
because per Bill Gates, that's all anyone could possibly ever need.
So they added, besides that, they also added support for the BK-90 submunition suspension. The Swedes are against cluster bombs, so it's not a cluster bomb, despite the fact that it is a flying thing that dispenses a bunch of smaller munitions.
Not a cluster bomb. Shut up.
Yeah, not a cluster bomb. And the RB-15 anti-ship missile, they added a terrain contour matching navigation system, something first seen in American cruise missiles all the way back to the 1960s, which kind of surprised me when I found that out.
Yeah.
You would have thought that that's something that's a little bit processor power intensive, but I guess we managed it in the 1960s, so it can't be that hard. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, we also went to the moon in the 1960s.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a lot easier than. Yeah. Well, whatever. Not where I was going with that, but moon.
Yeah. So the AJS-37 maintains all the earlier Viggen's wonderful flying characteristics. It's excellent speed at low altitude. It's high lift and low landing speed. It's maneuverability through the first 180 degrees or so. There's a lot of induced drag, given that you've got delta wings and canards, which are effectively smaller delta wings.
Right. Without like some serious optimization and control surface design, you are basically in a draggy pig.
And this was the 1970s, so we didn't really have that.
Advanced design. Nope. Gripen or Rafale, this ain't.
Yes. Those are much, much better designed deltas with fancy computer systems to do the control pull exactly right. Whereas this just had a little autopilot stability thing. Actually, the autopilot too. That's another good feature they had. This is actually all the way back to the original in the 1970s. Had an attitude hole autopilot that would happily put you into a nice constant rate turn if you hit the trim stick to one side, and an altitude autopilot too. along with a bunch of other fancy landing-related pilot fun features. I've got a couple of Viggen videos that I'll put in the description, things I streamed while explaining various things to a couple of different viewers. And I'll link to those. Those are a much better explanation because I've actually got the stuff in front of me in those, and I can talk about things as I'm doing them. Yeah. Or in some cases, begin talking about things and then go, oh no, I've done something wrong, and then stop until I do it right again.
It's all right. We're only human.
Like you do. So I should actually explain what those videos are from, because our friends, well, not really our friends, they didn't give us a preview key for the Viggen.
But jerks.
I don't know if I'm going to go that far. They still made a pretty good thing, and you know, we're not all that big yet.
Yeah, but you know, the
mean one. Anyway, our acquaintances at Leatherneck Studios, who brought us the DCS MiG-21, have done it again with the DCS Viggen.
Which, for all the world, cockpit-wise, reminds me of an X-Wing.
It's true. You've got that... Well, you're back... You're in the third generation of fighters and the first generation of head-up displays, so... Yep. Nobody really had an idea of what standard symbology was. And the Viggen, of course, has a very low-powered computer and doesn't have a lot of cycles to spare on doing fancy things like letters or numbers. So a lot of the symbology you get is given to you in lines. And most notably, there is a series of three posts on the HUD of a you know, increasing length from inside to outside, look kind of like a little tunnel you're flying down, or perhaps a trench.
Yeah, in some kind of Death Star.
If you've got this giant central scope.
Yep.
Yeah, all these like little gauges around the outside. It is very X-Wing. It's probably as close as you can get to an X-Wing simulator on this.
Right. Yeah. That's actually a real plane. It also kind of struck me, you know, in the original Star Wars movies, they were trying to make something, you know, kind of futuristic looking. But you didn't have a lot. They didn't have a big budget. You didn't have a lot you could do with computers in the 70s. So you really get, really, this is that perfect thing where it's got a computer, but the display's all wonky because they don't know what they're doing yet. Or in Star Wars, because you're trying to look futuristic and different, but make some sense that nobody's going to ask too many questions about. And you still have some gauges because things need gauges, but you don't want to have too many gauges because that would look, you know, too old school, too much like the F4 Phantom we know and love. So you really get this really nice little hybrid display, complete with a little like scope to one side, like a targeting computer.
Yeah, and so use that for aiming Mavericks when you launch those. Anyway, so the Viggen is of course very well modeled. I think it's a good looking plane, I think, and a good looking representation of a pretty good looking plane. The cockpit modeling is, of course, spectacular with lovely soft lighting. The radar scope throws this eerie green glow over everything, like it, you know, would.
Right, yeah.
Fun fact, the Swedes, because again, this is back in the very early days of displays, nobody's quite sure what they're doing, displays no return as green and yes return as black, because that makes perfect sense.
Yep.
Yeah.
So it's also, like, the most basic-looking, crummy, you know, PPI display you can think of.
There's a B-scope mode. I just haven't quite worked out exactly what it points at most of the time. So.
Yeah. Why don't you tell us how you interact with this computer? Suppose you are some kind of, you know, Swedish X-Wing Viking pilot thing, and you're in your Viking X-Wing, and you want to tell the computer something. How do you do it?
Okay, so over on your right side, there's this little 9-button keypad, you know, from 10-button keypad from 0 to 9, right?
Like you do.
And a knob with a mode. And then a switch that's labeled in or out. And if you want to put something into the computer, you put the knob to the right mode, put the switch to in, and then enter it on the keypad.
Right.
So for instance, loading from the data cartridge, you put the switch to tact for, like, I'm not sure exactly what that means, but
something in Swedish.
The upshot is it's for interacting with the computer's memory. You put the switch to in, you enter 9099 and press enter, and then on the little, there's a 6-number display from, that's all you get. You get 6 numbers, not even letters or dashes or anything, no symbols, just 6 numbers.
Yep.
You enter 90, you see the 9099 up there. The first 9 flashes while it loads, then goes to all zeros, and that's how you know it's done. And that's pretty much how it works. There's a current position mode that shows you your longitude, then your latitude. Isn't that the and so it's called Ref Lola, for that matter, because, you know, long lat.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. No, what could be more intuitive than that?
It's very properly old-timey and does require quite a bit of writing down on the old cheat sheet.
Yep. To be fair to Saab, though, you know, this was the 70s, and they were probably high as kites and had no idea what they were doing because really nobody had done this before. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's a fairly crappy cockpit, too. I mean, it's not as poorly designed as a Soviet one of the same era. There's a good flow to things. But at the same time, there are a lot of switches and a lot of dials you got to pack in and not a lot of room for, like, a bigger keyboard. And at the same time, you... It's a, you know, a 1971 computer. There's not a lot of processing power to figure out letters.
Right, yeah. Letters. Those are hard.
Yeah. Actually, I don't believe there are letters displayed anywhere in the cockpit except on the destination indicator, which is the letters there are just waypoint types, which are probably stored in the computer as numbers and just translated to letters because that's slightly easier for you to read.
Right. But yeah, no, it's perfect. Yeah. Then with all those, you know, Swedish mountains, you got, you know, basically a really good, you know, terrain following experience. Get lots of practice, crash sometimes.
Nice. Down low. You know, there's it's really very fun. And it's like one of the first times I've gotten a sense of speed out of DCS is zipping over the, like a treetop height and a slight bank over a hill, watching the trees flash by at like 300 knots.
Nice.
Yeah. The sound design is also pretty good, especially in the cockpit. The cockpit sounds, I think, are incredible.
Well, that's where we want our sound to be good.
The afterburner has a nice meaty tone to it, and it's distinct in all three stages. You can really start to tell the difference as you get familiar with it.
You just need to tell
like how fast you're going. Yeah, the cockpit switches have really satisfying thunks.
Well, that's one of the joys of the 60s and 70s, isn't it? Yeah, really good.
Satisfying, good switch work.
Yeah, no, these modern buttons, they just don't, like, that, and press.
And there's the this use of plastic in modern things.
Right.
This is a metal switch, like, actuating a metal thing, but like a metal contact. It goes, like, chunk.
God and John Backus intended.
Exactly. there are so many really really well thought out and really kind of almost warm sounds it makes. Like, you turn the power on and you hear the computer fans behind you spinning up. The canary makes this really sad, like, ooh, noise as it lowers over your head.
Hey, I think that's also an X-Wing sound effect.
I think it is, actually. This is an X-Wing.
It's an X-Wing. It's made, you know, by, like, stone Vikings.
Now, as far as complexity goes, that's a usual, like, DCS bugaboo, I guess. But it's not as complicated as, say, the BMS F-16.
Right.
Which is, you know, very complicated plane, which is a modern multi-role thing with a lot of fancy advanced weapons. The Viggen is not. The Viggen has a couple of modern advanced weapons with a couple of very simple programming features, except for the RBS. Except for the RB-15 at a ship missile. There's a lot of programming there. But you can safely ignore most of it. I mean, you can either do it on the ground or just forget about it. It's not all that important. You've got a bunch of dumb bombs and manually guided weapons, which are, you know, straightforward to use. The HUD symbology is maybe not intuitive because it's 1971 and nobody's really built a HUD before.
No.
But it's not that hard to pick up. I learned just about everything as far as procedures go in an evening, although I did spend a lot of time reading the manual ahead of time. It's not that hard to get grips with, and it's not that hard to fly a mission as long as you're willing to put the time in to learn it, which I think is a reasonable ask.
Yeah, and like in terms of watching you, you know, the it's under other DCS planes. I think it's a little more complicated than, say, MiG-21.
Well, I don't know if I agree with that, though. Really? The MiG-21 is it's a very simple aircraft as far as its systems go, but the way you interact with them is in a lot of ways more complicated. Like, there's a weapon selector on the Viggen that you set to the right mode for the weapons you're carrying, and a master mode selector you put to there are a couple of, like, it's either in nav or in the onfall, the attack mode, for pretty much all the weapons. So you have to know which of the, whether it's in nav or whether it's in the onf mode. But beyond that, it's just putting the knob in the right position for the weapon you want to drop, setting your master mode, flipping the trigger safety up, and, you know, pulling the trigger. That's what it all boils down to, and that's a. And the MiG, I guess, is more or less the same, but there's a lot more complicated interplay in setting the switches up. And you, like switching from missiles to guns, there are many switches involved. Whereas the Viggen, by its mission profile, which is to say one pass, doesn't involve very much in the way of weapon switching in the first place. And when it does, it's more straightforward, I think, because of the way that the switches are labeled.
Fair enough.
But yeah, it's kind of on par with that in complexity. It's not that hard to learn. You'll be comfortable. If you're a sim pilot of average skill, you'll be comfortable flying it in an hour or two. You'll be comfortable with the weapons in probably a day or two of study.
Yeah, I think it's fair. And that's like, I think that's like most DCS planes.
Yeah, except for the A-10.
Right. And the A-10 is interesting because it's like stupidly simple to fly. But and the basic weapons are really easy, and then there's some advanced features that are quite a bit harder.
Once you get into the modern multi-role stuff, which it can do.
Yeah.
And I guess the A-10's mission profile also lends itself to a lot of loitering. Right. And,
that is true. Like, the A-10, you can really, like...
Loitering and data entry are things that you have to know in the A-10.
All right. Yeah. Autopilot on. Get us a nice little bank going, and then plug your manual.
You know, like 8 million things.
And you know, coordinates and other coordinates.
Put in a waypoint from the forward air controller.
Yep. On the other hand, the A-10 has, you know, intelligible... modern symbology.
Well, the A-10, if you've flown other American planes in Sims, you'll know what's going on in the HUD.
Yep.
Whereas the Viggen, you kind of have to read the manual to, you know, get a good sense for what this weird Death Star trench thing means and why there's this line that shrinks and gets bigger on the bottom of the HUD.
So it'd actually be really interesting to look at some, like, other 1960s HUDs, because I know, you know, this is, like, kind of the era of transition. The Phantom had a HUD, sort of. You know, the Crusader had something.
I'd be very interested in seeing the Corsairs, because it's, again, like, one of the first, if not the first, airplanes in its role from its country. So they're operating the same territory, the completely untested, the uncharted frontier of design.
Yep. Cue the Star Trek theme. Right?
Da, 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 da.
Yep, that. So that'd be interesting too to look at. I don't think we have a good Corsair Sim.
No.
I have a Corsair book.
Actually, what's the name? Razbam, they're making one.
Oh, yeah. Are
they? So that'll be another DCS thing. And maybe someday they'll be able to fly off.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, and it's, well, of course, there's some, like, interesting weapons, and it's got those bigger American bombs.
Yeah, and some bomb variety too.
Right.
Whereas the Swedes were like, 120 kilograms is fine for anything.
Right.
No, it isn't. It's mostly for, you know, I'm going to shoot this at the mess of vehicles there.
Right. Well,
we'll save our stock of valuable manual control guided missiles for the bridge pylons.
Right. It's interesting, though, because, you know, right around the time that the Swedes are here, you know, the Swedes have said, I don't know, it would be really interesting to find out. They said, you know, 120 kilos is the right size. It's good enough. At least the time the Viggen was designed, that's Vietnam, and we in this country said, you know, 250 kilograms, just roughly the same weight.
Pounds.
Sorry, 250 pounds, roughly the same weight as 120 kilos. And we said those are, you know, useless and stupid, and what would anybody want with those little pieces of crap?
Go 500 the smallest.
Man. Yeah, no, 500, that's your, like, your safe bombs.
Yeah.
Danger close only.
Yeah.
But it was a happier time.
Yeah. You know. I mean, you couldn't get them where they were supposed to go quite as easily.
No, but you could load, like, you know, about over 100 into the belly of a B-52 and make a section of jungle just explode.
I mean, even in the Viggen, which is a single-engine strike fighter, you put 16 of the things on it. So that's a nice line.
No, yeah, but it's not.
They had a few hundred of them at the peak of the Swedish Air Force.
So. Oh, there you go. So, yeah, that's enough to, like, that's enough for two arc light strikes. Yeah. Congratulations.
Yeah. Well, it's not a lot of strategic weapons in the Swedish arsenal for, what's it called?
For shame.
Actually, they were working on a nuclear program in the 1960s, but they abandoned it. The 50s and 60s, but they gave up.
Jerks.
Or just decided not to for some reason.
Yeah, I don't know why.
Yeah.
Well, you know, whatever. I mean, I think the independent nuclear capability is something that's, you know, wildly underrated. Unless you're, you know, an evil king and tyrant or something, in which case you know the value of the nuclear program.
Yep. I think that about covers it for tonight.
Yeah, I think so.
Not a super organized one, but, you know.
That's okay.
You know, this is another one of those emergency episodes that we...
We just threw this together based on, you know, things we love.
Yeah.
You know, guns, weird oddball Swedish fighters.
Yeah. Stupid modern polymer frame pistols.
Wonderful modern polymer frame pistols.
Says the guy whose, you know, carry holster contains a modern polymer frame. It does have a hammer, though, okay? It's fine. It's allowed.
He's not too with it, okay? His pistol is, you know, unpopular and unloved by basically the entire internet. You know how hard that is for the entire internet to say your carry pistol sucks?
I don't know if it's, they say it sucks. They just, like, nobody's heard of it.
No. There's definitely some suckage threads out there. But yeah, no, since he is a hipster, even though it's a modern polymer frame pistol designed in 2000-something. Though we're working on him. Don't worry. We're going to try to get him to carry this pig. This 92 is going in his holster soon.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, come on, this is a lot more reassuring.
And a lot scarier.
It really is. Yeah.
Although the PX4 does have that curious, like the barrel is, well, no, not in this, but on the subcomet, the barrel actually is, it flares at the front, so it looks much larger than it actually, like the bore is And yeah. I think that's probably almost entirely an intimidation feature because it's a fairly small pistol.
Oh, the that'll intimidate them. But you know who used this pistol? Like every action hero in the 1980s, that's who. Yeah. You know, John McClane, Riggs. And you could almost pull off Riggs if only you had a mullet.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen.
No, I'm pretty sure, like... That, no.
Yeah.
No, your wife would come at you with like a pair of scissors and a crazy looking around.
I mean, my hair gets a little bit long in the back between haircuts, but it's also long in the front, so it doesn't quite fit the mullet.
Right, you have to trim it in the front, but not the back.
It's more like a beetle than a...
but I mean, as far as I know, Ringo Starr never had one of these things.
Neither, I wouldn't expect he did.
No. But, so, yep, look at us babbling away. Thanks for wasting another hour with us.
Yeah, you have indeed. I mean, like, this is even a less structured hour than usual. So we thank you for your time, I guess.
Yeah.
We'll leave you with that. The Crossbox Podcast is produced by my co-host John and me, Jay, and is brought to you by Many Words Press, online at manywords.press. I should also note that we've got a book coming out in about a month. You should stop by manywords.press/buybooks for the pre-order link, which I will have to put up before I publish this tomorrow. Our theme music is Royal Rumble by Jay Mann of ironmusicbox.com and is used under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution License. And you can keep up with us, the Crossbox contributors, between podcasts at soapbox.manywords.press.